Hello, I am Pete Real, a high school English and Spanish teacher, an avid reader, and an aspiring writer. Thank you for listening to the Chills at Will podcast, in which we explore the visceral beauty of literature and its connection to our culture, our history, and ourselves. Hello and welcome to episode 63 of the Chills at Will podcast. It's a pleasure to have with me today Eric Nussbaum. Eric Nussbaum is a writer and former editor at Vice. His work has appeared in Sports Illustrated, ESPN The Magazine, The Daily Beast, Deadspin, and the Best American Sports Writing Anthology. Born and raised in Los Angeles, he has also lived and worked in Mexico City, New York, and Seattle. He now lives in Tacoma, Washington with his family. Eric, thanks so much for joining me today. How are you?
Doing well. How you doing?
Pretty good, thanks. I've read over your bio a few times, and it was the first time that Deadspin really stood out to me. Was this like pre-Deadspin kind of imploding?
Oh, yeah. That's an old bio now. This was, I don't think I've even written for Deadspin since 14 maybe.
Okay. That was just about when I picked it up. I was really late to the game. They had some incredible work going on. What kind of stuff did you do for Deadspin?
I just kind of did freelance stuff here and there for the most part. Features. I did the last thing I did for them was a huge, huge quote unquote long, the right word, story about table tennis. And the went to the U.S. Open of table tennis in Grand Rapids, Michigan.
Oh,
wrote about it. I love ping pong. And it was a story I had been wanting to write forever. So they gave me the go ahead.
Is ping pong 100% synonymous with table tennis?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, I thought so. It's just a little classier way maybe of saying it.
I think the insecure people say table tennis.
That's awesome. Anyways, besides that little Deadspin tangent there, really, again, welcome. Thanks so much. Anything that you would like to add about about your bio? Anything that I left out on the intro?
No, I don't think so. The author of a book.
What's that book called?
It's called Stealing Home.
Yes.
And I think that's why I'm here.
It is. That's one of the many reasons. You're not going to see it on video, listeners at home, but I have Stealing Home right above my rightish shoulder here. Stealing Home by Eric Nussbaum. Came out in 2020, is that correct?
Yep, March 2020.
Awesome. We're going to definitely talk about that a little bit later. That is fresh in my mind as I just finished it a couple of days ago. It was a heck of a book, heck of an accomplishment. Coming up in Los Angeles or Los Angeles proper, what were you reading? Who were some of the writers? I guess more so like in the household, was it a print-rich environment? Were you the type that was, reading comic books or heavy stuff when you were 6 years old? What was kind of like your reading life like as a kid?
I like that phrase, print-rich environment. Mm. It was a print-rich environment. My parents were definitely readers, reading books. They read the newspaper every morning. So as a kid, I started reading the sports page every morning.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure that was a key influence on me. Probably wasn't thinking about that at the time, but reading like Jim Murray, in the LA Times or Bill Plaschke or whoever it was. I think, and then books, I read a ton, my parents read a ton. My grandparents read a ton. I just love books, whether it was like, the Phantom Tollbooth or Jurassic Park or, A Tree Grows in Brooklyn or whatever it was, my parents were always giving me books. My family was giving me books. I was insatiable.
Nice. That's great to hear. Some classics, some legends, Jim Murray, like you said, Bill Plaschke, before he was even known as an ESPN guy, he was a heck of an LA Times writer, right? That's awesome. Now, the physical newspaper, which some people listening to this in 5 years might say, what does that even mean? What even, is that, right? But some Phantom Tollbooth, there's some classics there. Did you read necessarily like for sports? Did you read like sports biographies, Sports Illustrated?
Definitely.
Just kind of all of the above.
I read everything, but I love sports as a kid. So I remember, I got Sports Illustrated for kids and then I got the real Sports Illustrated and I read that. I read these baseball biographies, especially in boxing biographies. I loved this one book called My Favorite Summer in 1956. Mm-hmm. It was a ghostwritten Mickey Mantle autobiography. And for some reason I latched onto it. I probably read it 100 times.
Nice. Was it appropriate for kids?
Semi. Yeah.
Okay.
I don't think I realized the inappropriate places, but it was also like, you know, definitely not the true dirty details of Mickey Mantle's life.
Sure. Have you ever seen the movie A Bronx Tale?
Yeah.
You remember when he's asking about Mickey Mantle? He says, nobody cares. Mickey Mantle's going to pay your rent, something like that. Right. I think it was either in the acknowledgments or some biography I was reading about you that you're bilingüe, hablas español muy bien, or
sí, más o menos hablo español.
Más o menos. Like, is that from your family or is that from education or both?
Both. My mom's family is Cuban. My mom's mom is from Havana, and my mom lived there when she was little, and they moved to Miami after the revolution.
Mm-hmm.
61, I think they moved.
Okay.
And so, you know, she's bilingual, speak Spanish. My grandmother spoke Spanish, my aunts. And so that was a part of my culture growing up and my life. And my education too, I went to a bilingual elementary school.
Oh,
and
really cool.
Learned it in school too. So you know, I'm pretty blessed with kind of that Spanish rich environment as well as the print rich environment.
Very cool. As far as the writing part of it goes, obviously to become a great writer, you need to read, read, read. Were there certain points where you were writing stuff on your own for school? Or like I said, or on your own just for fun. Was there like a moment where you're like, dang, I can do this thing. Like people enjoy my writing.
I don't know if there was one moment. There was like lots of little moments, mm-hmm. you know, I definitely not in school where I was like, I'm going to be a writer. I liked writing in school and I mm-hmm. felt pretty confident in it. And I, you know, I think I did okay in it, but I was not somebody who was like plotting out his career as a novelist sure. or something like that. It was something I would like to do and was interested in, but I would go beyond that. I mainly like reading.
Yeah. 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 Of course. You know, so the name of the podcast is the Chills at Will podcast. It's this idea of the lines that thrill you that you can come up with on demand, the books, the poems, the writers who give you chills at will. I wonder if there are one or two or a couple that you might think of that have really just been transformational almost in your life.
Oh God, there's so many.
Yeah.
The one I come back to right now, especially with this book, mm-hmm. is John Dos Passos.
Okay.
And I think about the USA trilogy as sort of the like spiritual ancestor of Stealing Home in a way. It's not even just like on a line level. It's on a sort of storytelling narrative canvas level. It's what he does with structure. And it's the way that a writer can get so deep and so personal and so like evocative
mm-hmm.
in one moment and then pull it back to being this big picture thing the next, mm-hmm. all while, you know, kind of telling a tale. And I think that's probably those are the chills that like informed me at the mm-hmm. point where I was writing this book, for sure.
Yeah. Oh, that makes a lot of sense. Yeah, you do an incredible job with the micro and the macro in this book. We'll talk about that a little bit later, but the bird's eye view, and then like you said, the larger view, kind of zooming out. Let's talk baseball and the Dodgers. I mean, were you just like a diehard fan growing up? Was it just baseball? Were you into all kinds of sports? And also, you know, were you a player also? Just a fan?
I was a player and of all kinds of sports growing up, mm-hmm. you know, I loved sports. I was a fan of all sports, and baseball was my favorite. And that's still the case. I'm a fan of all sports, and baseball is my favorite. Hmm. I'm no longer a player of all sports, but with my kids, I guess.
Sure. Right. Yeah. We get that second career as fathers, right?
It's kind of fun.
You know, I didn't even know if I even mentioned it, obviously, but I mean, you grew up in LA, you grew up in Culver City. Is that right?
That's right.
Like a suburb of, right? Okay.
Yeah, sort of like a pocket suburb mm-hmm. inside of LA. It's a weird mm-hmm. setup.
So growing up, and I speak as someone born in 1980, so I was 8 years old when they won in 88. I was actually at game 5 where Ole Hershiser struck out, I want to say Tony Phillip, but they beat the A's. And then we had a 32-year drought until last year, right? So what were those years like as a Dodgers fan? I mean, we had our success for sure, but...
I mean... I think they were up and down. You know, I was 2 in 88 when they won the World Series. I don't remember it. To me, it exists kind of in the form of that Kirk Gibson highlight. That's sort of like the never-ending loop that was just played forever and ever and mm-hmm. ever. over the last 32 years in LA. And I think it's nice to exercise that a little bit from our consciousness and move forward without it. And I think that that clip is sort of like, to me, the definition of the last 32 years. It's like, yeah, things have been good, but like nothing has matched that. And so we just kind of keep living in the past. But I don't know, it's been a pretty good thing to be a Dodger fan. They've been almost always entertaining. There's been a lot of drama, you know, the McCourt stuff.
Oh yeah.
Fox, you know, like it's been bad stuff for sure. But overall, they most years, especially the last decade, have been a very good team. They've given us a lot of fun players to watch, you know, from the 90s to now.
Yeah.
I can't really complain too much.
Yeah.
I live in Seattle, area now in Tacoma, and Mariners haven't even been to the World Series in their existence. So who am I to complain about Dodger fandom?
We talked about some of the Giants who've inspired you as writers. What is it, I guess now is the transition into you as a professional writer. Where, you know, how did you go from really enjoying reading and being a good writer to writing for big time outlets like Vice and Deadspin and being, you know, included in the Best American Sports Writing Anthology? Where did those things kind of come together?
You know, it came together slowly and then quickly, and then slowly again, and then quickly again. When I was in college, I sort of started to realize that I really loved it, you know, beyond just sort of casually. And I was blessed with some great teachers in high school and college and after college who have helped me, I think, realize my potential in writing. I, you know, had this great poetry professor in college named Rick Kenny at University of Washington, and he like blew my mind and kind of expanded the way I thought about words and about even seeing the world and observing the world.
Yeah.
I had a great, you know, short story teacher in LA in a UCLA extension program after college when I was, you know, already a mid-career journalist named Lou Matthews, who's still a friend and mentor and allowed me to really like understand narrative better. Basically, and like think in terms of story in a way I hadn't been doing. The writers who inspire me, honestly, like writers on the page, you know, beautiful prose inspires me, obviously. But what inspires me the most is writers who are able to like make the practice of writing their life in a way that is sustainable and generous and empathetic. And that's what amazes me. So in terms of my own journey, I started writing in college more, you know, short stories and poetry and stuff like that and creatively. And then after college, I kind of bounced around. I didn't know what I wanted to do with myself. You know, it was the recession. I graduated in 2008 and had a lot of jobs. Not many of them lasted very long, sometime in between jobs. And I, on the side, I started a baseball blog just as an outlet. And that was called Pitchers and Poets. And that blog is what sort of led me into, you know, thinking more deeply about sports and writing about them. And it led to my first opportunities to write online. I would say that's how I got into Best American Sports Writing.
Okay.
That's how I got into writing for Slate or whoever it was. And it really like, it was just about, you know, putting in the work and sending cold emails to editors and reading a lot and trying to file decent stories and getting better at it.
Yeah. I'll make sure that I link the essay, if we can, the Best American Sports Writing Anthology. What was that about basically?
It was about a young kid who was a baseball player in Juarez, Mexico, who was killed in a narco-related crime.
Whoa.
And the mystery surrounding his death.
Wow.
And it feels like a million years ago I wrote that, but it was more than 10 years ago.
So I wonder about, you know, obviously being a professional writer and doing that for a living, is it something where when you read others' work, do you enjoy it in a different way or you're not able to enjoy it as much? You know what I mean? To be like a basketball coach watching a game and like, you know, at the X's and O's of it. Does that affect the way that you read now that you write for a living?
I don't think it's that I write for a living. I think, you know, I read probably with a pretty critical eye. Also worked as an editor. But if I'm being honest, the moment that I stop being able to enjoy reading for pleasure, like the moment that I can't get carried away by the magic of a story or a book or a poem, I probably won't be much of a writer anymore.
Yeah.
For me, like writing is pleasure and reading especially is pleasure. Like sometimes you have to do it for work. You're reading dry stuff for research or whatever it is, but I love to read. And I think that absorbing, you know, somebody's writing in a state of like vulnerability and not being just a critical jerk the whole time
right.
makes the experience so much better.
I appreciate that. What was it like to write for, I mean, just giants, Sports Illustrated, ESPN, the magazine? Was that something where you were able to basically write what you wanted to, or was it a little bit, had to be geared toward a certain audience?
Oh, I mean, it was really cool.
Yeah.
It was surreal. I had, you know, grew up reading Sports Illustrated in particular, and then ESPN, the magazine when that started off. And, if you would have told me that I would write for Sports Illustrated, I would have never believed you. Hmm. And I mean, I was a freelancer. I wasn't on staff or anything, but I don't think I wrote differently. You know, I try to write in a way that's pretty clear. And like, I'm not like too pyrotechnic in my style. You know, try to report well and tell a good story. You know, what's nice about those places is that you get fact checkers and you have good layers of editors who are there to help you and support the work.
Mm-hmm.
You get paid, you know, a living wage, at least at the time I was writing for them, to write, which is really nice because a lot of the time you're freelancing and you're hustling and you're getting paid nothing. And you know, you want to make the piece great, but it's hard economically to justify the time. Mm-hmm. And when you're writing for, when I was writing for those magazines, you know, I was able to put the time in because they were paying me to put the time in, and it was made the pieces way better, you know, covering expenses for travel and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a pleasure. To be honest. And it was scary for sure. Cause I was like, you know, wow, this is my chance. But ultimately you have to trust yourself to just do the best work you can.
This is kind of apropos of nothing, but when you were speaking earlier, you said, you talked about being allowed to realize your potential. That's just, you know, the greatness of language, you know, in Spanish, right? It's like, I always thought it was so cool. That's realizarse. And that doesn't mean to realize I get it. It's more like to fulfill your potential.
Yeah, that's
right?
True.
I just love how it's got the double meaning even in English, right? To realize
your
potential. So again, apropos of nothing, but speaking to a fellow Spanish speaker and a heck of a writer, I thought I wanted to mention that. You wrote a book that's called Stealing Home, Los Angeles, the Dodgers, and the Lives Caught in Between. Is it a trend to have huge subtitles these days?
I guess it is. I think that there was a for nonfiction books, I believe that you are sort of like required to have one.
Okay.
Unless you're really famous. I believe the descriptive subtitle is, it's not just about like marketing, but I think it has to do with like how they actually categorize the books and the systems that go behind like bookstores and Amazon and all that stuff is my understanding of it. But I usually just say Stealing Home when people ask me what the book is called.
Right. And that makes sense. It was actually funny. I was recommending the book to a family member the other day, and I was like, yeah, it's called Stealing Home, and they're like is there more to the title? And I was like, dang, you're right, yes, there is more to the title. Let me tell you. It seems like it started with a visit by a guy named Frank Wilkinson, who I would think most or a lot of LA people would know, or some would, maybe of an older generation. Can you talk a little bit about the background, and maybe it even started before that, but that visit by Frank Wilkinson that really kind of got the gears in motion?
Yeah, I mean, it did start with that. When I was in high school, a junior in my U.S. history class, Frank Wilkinson was this guest speaker we had to talk about the Red Scare and McCarthyism. He was going to talk about his experience being blacklisted, which was interesting, you know, to me.
Sure.
I like history, obviously. And he came in and he was this, you know, very old man, white hair and a kind of gravelly voice. And he said, you know, who here is a Dodger fan? And I raised my hand. He said, well, Dodger Stadium should not exist. I remember those words.
Ooh.
And I was like, whoa, what's he talking about? You know, I was obsessed with baseball and that was crazy to imagine. And he kind of begins to unspool, you know, these events that led to his firing from the housing authority and his blacklisting and his life getting ruined in the 1950s. And it, yeah, blew my mind. And that never really, I just never stopped thinking about it. And, you know, as I grew up and became a writer, the questions that he had brought up that day continued to gnaw at me. And I continued to feel like it was a meaningful, powerful story. Mm. And I knew I wanted to write a book about it at some point. And that's what I finally was able to do.
Was there like kind of what made the timing right? Or was it just, it was going to happen? It just kind of happened.
I mean, it wasn't that it just kind of happened. Like I had been trying to do it actively for years. I don't think there was just one thing that made the timing right. You know, in the beginning, I found a lot of people in the publishing world were just not interested in the story.
Mm.
And it's a story about LA and housing and immigration and race and baseball, obviously, and local politics. It's like a pretty complicated mix up of stuff that makes up what I think is an emotionally, you know, powerful and important story. Obviously, I wouldn't have written the book if I didn't feel that way. But selling it to somebody who's not familiar with LA or is predisposed to kind of being like, eh, I don't know about that, was tricky. And I didn't have as much experience as a writer. I didn't have like a big name brand or a huge Twitter following or anything like that. So people just kept on saying, ah, it's too esoteric. It's too LA. It's too local. And I kind of went on in my career, you know, lived in Mexico City for a couple of years, and that only fed my interest in writing about this. Finally, I was working at Vice in LA and knowing I really wanted to write this book, and also knowing that the journalism world around me was shrinking. You know, you can just feel it. Places are closing, people are getting laid off all the time, newspapers are shuttering. My own company was laying off staff. You know, most of our sports staff got laid off in one fell swoop. And I was left over, and I was like, wow, you know, this is going to be it. Like, I'm next, basically. So that was when I really started to push and was able to get set up with an agent and get the book to an editor who wanted it. And it worked out, you know, great. I left Vice when I got an advance. It was not a large one, but it was enough, you know, after planning for it to do it and spend a year full time on the book.
You know, part of what makes the book great is that you have so many intertwined stories that really do make, you know, the one strong narrative. But I guess you could say the main character or main characters is Frank, or most likely probably the
Arechigas,
Abrana and Manuel, right? And this talks about the three neighborhoods, Palo Verde, Bishop, and La Loma. Did I get those correct?
Yes, sir.
Which kind of make up what is called Chavez Ravine now?
Yeah.
Fair to say?
It's fair to say.
Yeah. You know, you listen to Vin Scully and the Dodgers, and they talk about, you know, welcome to Chavez Ravine, that type of thing. And as Frank Wilkinson said, they were, and it was not a simple story, but they were kicked out in many ways to bring land to what ended up becoming the Dodgers. I wonder about your research for the book, and I wonder about the idea of burden's not the right word, but just kind of the pressure or the responsibility you felt to get the story right with the Arechigas and the family and, you know, their descendants. Like, you know, how do you kept you honest, I guess, if you want, writing the book?
I mean, I think that burden, it's a burden, it's an obligation, the most important thing for a nonfiction writer, for a reporter. Like, every time I write about somebody's life, I feel like I'm holding something sacred in my hands. Like, it takes a lot of vulnerability to share your story with somebody, a lot of trust.
Sure.
You know, and these are family secrets. These are traumas that they're opening up to show me. And when I'm writing about somebody, I really want to get that right. You know, I want to respect them as much as I can and be as empathetic as I can and be as factual as I can. And that's, I think that's every writer's obligation, but every nonfiction writer's obligation.
Sure.
It was a huge aspect of the book. Obviously you're going off of people's memories, which can be shoddy. You're having to decide maybe between which competing story is correct. You're having to make judgments, but you want to be thoughtful and conscientious about how you make those choices. So I guess I couldn't really like imagine doing it without being really thoughtful about those people. Yeah. And I mean, honestly, the book wouldn't exist without them, because so much of what makes the book work is the oral histories that were shared with me and that I'm so grateful for.
Who was kind of your main or your first point person? Like, you know, did you get in touch with a member of the family, or how did that work that you were start able to compile the information?
I mean, I was trying different things. The first person I spoke to was I'm trying to think actually, who was the first person I spoke to? God, the first person I interviewed who was a member of the community was a guy named Al Zepeda. We met at Elysian Park in LA near where Dodger Stadium is, and we talked, and he was great and really helpful and generous with his time. And it was really hard. You know, I was going through old articles about the communities and then calling people based on looking them up on the white pages and finding their phone numbers. I didn't have any ins or anything like that.
Yeah.
So I was just kind of cold calling and hoping to earn trust from people. What really helped me break through with telling the story of the Arechigas was, in particular, I got to know Melissa Arechiga, who was the great granddaughter of Abrana.
Okay.
And she has a nonprofit called Buried Under the Blue that does a lot of like tenants' rights organization stuff. And she's very political. You know, she's an activist. And like talking to her about, you know, the political issues at play in the story, and her partner in that organization, Vincent Montalvo, was sort of like the key that unlocked speaking to a lot of the people that were close to the Arechiga family. And so they were a great help. But they also, you know, they held me accountable, and they said, you know, you have to do this, this, and this in a way that's respectful of our story. And I understood that. There were tons of people who shared their homes with me and shared their stories with me. And I'm really grateful to all of them.
The idea of like, putting together dialogue, like you said, that happened in, you know, 1945 or those type of things, or putting together, you know, some of these times you talked about the weather. I mean, I guess you could get the weather from the archives, but how were you able to reconstruct so many things that happened so long ago?
Very carefully. And like, I actually, it's sort of a trick. I didn't do that much reconstruction. There's scenes where you're reconstructing. Like, I know what the weather was because I could look at the LA Times that day or the previous day, or, you know, you can look at historic weather charts. That's easy to find.
Okay.
Sometimes it's good to throw the weather in there for for detail. There's not a lot of dialogue from, you know, reconstructed dialogue. There's, you know, things people might've said, like Abrana used to say this, like as a catchphrase, or like Manuel, her husband, would always have a, you know, a candy in his pocket for his grandkids, you know, and I could use that detail and mention it, but I'm not going to say, you know, on October 7th, 1953, Manuel Arechiga gave a candy bar to his grandson.
Right.
I don't know. I don't know when that happened or not. So sure. I wouldn't. I just wouldn't say that. I would just talk about their personalities and not try to invent scenes.
There's just an incredible mosaic of stories. I mean, there's General Santa Ana. There's, you know, Abner Doubleday, there's Veracruz in Mexico. There's, you know, all these things that you, from the outside, you're like, what does that have to do with, you know, the Dodgers in Elysian Park, La Loma, you know, area of LA, like what the heck, but it just comes together so well. I wonder how you were able to, you know, especially in like in your drafting process, how are you able to stick to the main story while, you know, wrapping around all of these pieces that, again, from the outside might not seem to make much sense or be connected very strongly.
I'm not sure how I did it. You know, those like scenes where you see like the detective in the movie who's got like the charts all over the walls with like the strings connecting them, and they look like a completely crazy person. Like that was me writing the book. Like I was dreaming about the structure of the book and the characters in the book, and like really just out of my mind thinking about this stuff for months, year. And I knew that I wanted to include a lot, you know, and maybe some stuff you wouldn't expect. I had certain ideas about, you know, conquest that I wanted the book to include. I wanted the book to have a certain historical sweep that that would put things into context and maybe make them more affecting. And you can see how, you know, events rhymed over centuries a little bit without being too intrusive on the main story. And that was what I was going for. It was more about instilling a feeling in the reader than it was about like showing how these facts all align perfectly.
Mm-hmm. You talked about it rhyming. Did you see connections between what happened in the 50s, although it happened over a long period of time, but and what's happening today with housing, with racism? Did you see a lot of connections?
And yeah, how could you not?
Yes, period. You know,
we're pretty much, there's a lot of connections. It's a book about power and governments. It's a book about stadiums and real estate development. It's a book about race and racism. It's a book about fake news and misinformation and politics. Like these are all issues that we're facing today. There's a lot that rhymes. I mean, I was writing the book and researching the book, and it was unbelievable to me how similar certain things are. You know, there's a whole section of the book that deals with corruption in the LA City Council at the hands of real estate developers. And like, you know, right when the book came out, LA City Council member Jose Huizar was arrested by the FBI for taking bribes from real estate developers. Nothing really changes.
This might be one of the hardest to pull off, but it might be my best connection I've ever made. So I think it was Santayana who was the one who made the famous quote about, you know, learning from history or else we'll repeat our mistakes, to Santa Ana. I was just telling a friend about this yesterday. It had nothing to do with anything Dodgers related. Tell us about his wooden leg in baseball. So this was a crazy story.
Okay, so when I lived in Mexico City, I became interested in the subject of how baseball came to Mexico. There, I was doing an unrelated story about it, about baseball in Mexico. And I was like trying to kind of like figure out, like, when was the first baseball game played in Mexico? And there's different theories about, you know, whether it came over from Cuba, from American troops, whether it came from railroad workers in Texas. You know, there's nobody really sure. But one story that kept on popping up, like repeatedly, and I should say that when I lived in Mexico City, there was this great private archive of baseball history in Mexico City run by Alfred Harpalu, who's one of the richest men in Mexico and huge baseball fan. And it was in this house in just like a middle-class neighborhood, totally discreet. And it was so weird that this existed, but it was full of books and archives of Mexican baseball history. So I would just go down there and hang out for days. And so the one I kept on coming across was the story that during the Mexican-American War, Abner Doubleday, you know, who's going to go on to be famous for firing the first shots by the Union in Fort Sumter, going to go on to become famous as the supposed mythical inventor of baseball from Cooperstown, New York. He, after this battle in Veracruz, where the American troops conquer, you know, defeat Santa Anna, send him off running, and somehow end up with his prosthetic wooden leg, which, you know, Santa Anna had a wooden leg. He had lost a leg in battle against France some years before. That Doubleday says, oh, this is the perfect size for this game I just invented. And he marks out a baseball field in a park and he teaches the, you know, Illinois volunteers how to play baseball. And they play baseball with the Santa Anna's leg as the bat. That's the first game played in Mexico. It is such a ridiculous story. And obviously, I mean, Abner Doubleday did not invent baseball. He didn't even know what it was, but it was just the fact that that story has stuck around and it was repeated in guidebooks and it like became a thing. It was delightful to me. And also sort of meaningfully symbolic. So I wanted to include it because I think when it comes to baseball and Los Angeles, and this is something the book talks about, the myth matters as much or more than the facts and how things get told and, you know, how history unfolds.
Mm-hmm. 76 chapters in the book and it works. It works. What was the rationale on that?
I don't know. I wanted to be able to jump around in time a lot. I wanted to be able to jump between characters. I like short chapters as a reader. I didn't think it was going to be that extreme when I started, but I kind of started to feel like it was the best way to tell the story. You know, I'm not somebody who would have guessed that I would write a book with 76 chapters. You know, it's like a 300 page book too. It's not like it's like a 500 or 800 page tome.
Right.
But I thought it was a useful device for making each chapter matter, for keeping the pace going pretty quickly, especially in the beginning of the book. You know, we're talking about a book where we know the ending, right? Dodger Stadium gets built. And I wanted to create tension. And that was also a helpful tool for doing so.
Mm. Thank you for that. That's great writing advice. That makes a lot of sense. Yeah, it does keep the pace going. Like you said, you know the ending, but we do want to know how do we get there? You made the choice, and I think you maybe wrote about it in the preface, but you made the choice to avoid academic style footnotes. You have, you know, paragraphs at the end telling, you know, this comes from such and such, but I wonder why you decided to do that as well.
I just think they get in the way of readability, to be honest. I didn't really want to distract readers with it. I think that there's plenty of, you know, a place for that in academic books, but I'm not a professor. I don't work for university. I wasn't publishing for University Press. And I thought the story would work better on its own.
Yeah. I think maybe it might be a good opportunity now, if you wouldn't mind, if you could read the preface kind of towards the end.
Sure.
Hold on. You were saying that, I guess, if you're following at home, this would be the last paragraph on page 5, and it's of the preface.
I come at this book as a person who has spent many hours watching, writing about, and thinking about baseball. I come at it as a reporter who has worked in the United States and Mexico. I come at it as a native Angeleno who believes the story of my city has too often been told from the perspective of writers perched firmly on the East Coast and peering west as if through a pair of binoculars. On some level, I think I've wanted to write this book since the day I saw Frank Wilkinson in high school. The story broke my heart. I struggled to reconcile that Dodger Stadium, a place that I love so much, was also the source of pain to so many people. I've never had to pick up the pieces of a broken life like Frank Wilkinson, or build a life from scratch like Abrana Arechiga. I've never been displaced like the residents of Palo Verde, La Loma, and Bishop, but all four of my grandparents were, and I grew up hearing their stories. My father's parents were Jews in Poland during World War II. They both lost their homes and eventually their entire families in the Holocaust. My mother and her family lived in Havana until 1961. After the Cuban Revolution, they had to leave their apartment and their belongings behind because although my grandmother was Cuban, my grandfather was from the United States. One of the recurring themes of this book is how we rewrite history to suit our own present aim. This was especially true in the early days of baseball and especially true in the early days of Los Angeles. It has also been true when it comes to the story of baseball in Los Angeles. The story of Dodger Stadium has been condensed and mythologized. It has become, with good reason, a fable. The real history is less like a fable and more like the story of a crime that Los Angeles perpetuated on itself. For all its magic, Frank Wilkinson was right. Dodger Stadium should not exist. This book is my attempt to tell the story of why it does.
Thank you so much. I am physically not able to snap, but I would in agreement with how that's some great writing. I mean, the way that you set yourself up as, you know, you put yourself into the story, but talking about your privileges or lack thereof. The way that I love the line about the East Coast people kind of perched on there, you know, looking across to the West. Really, really good stuff. I'm thinking of the epigraph, I think it is for The Godfather, and it says, it's from Balzac, and it's something like, behind every great fortune, there's a crime. I'm thinking of the Dodgers, right?
It's true.
However, both you and me are still, I believe, big Dodgers fans.
Also true.
Right? I mean, football-wise, I'm a 49ers fan, sorry, in Northern California. And, you know, fairly big fan, not a huge fan, as big as a fan of basketball or baseball, but, you know, a lot of things over the years, the suicides, the CTE and all of that. And then, you know, for the Niners, Colin Kaepernick was to call anybody out for quote unquote, not being patriotic is ridiculous. To call out an African-American with the history of our country for not being patriotic. And so the whole Colin Kaepernick thing, right, was really upsetting to me. And we kind of saw how the sausage was made, so to speak, right, in sport. I'm sorry, it's a long-winded way of me saying basically like the idea of like the loss of innocence that really comes through in the book. You know, when we're kids, we're just loving the sport because it's, you know, we love the players and all of that. I wonder how writing the book and knowing the story has kind of overall affected your relationship with the Dodgers or with sports? It's a big question. Sorry.
No, it's not actually a big question. It's sort of the reason the book exists is untangling this relationship. And the book is in many ways an act of kind of wrestling with my own sports fandom. Mm. And I guess I come from the side of post-innocence sports fandom. Like I think you have to like accept or acknowledge that nothing is perfect, you know? The idea of a patriotism that doesn't involve any criticism is immature and silly. And it leads to, you know, descending into like fascist bullshit, right? Mm. The same way that's true. Sports fandom that doesn't involve any criticism of the institutions is sort of silly too. It's like this idea that sports is separate and immune from criticism, that sports, despite being this multi-bazillion dollar industry that has a huge influence on every aspect of our society and is totally connected to everything, is exempt from being thought about in any sort of deep way. It's just silly to me. So I love LA. It's a messed up city in many ways with a messed up history. I love the Dodgers and I love baseball. And, you know, it's okay to both love something and acknowledge its flaws and maybe work to improve on them.
So I guess the idea that you're able to kind of hold both of those in balance, is that, I mean, should we feel guilty for liking should we feel guilty for going to Dodger Stadium, which, you know, used to be the, I don't know if it was literally the parking lot of, what was the name of the church that was a big part of the community?
The Santo Niño Church.
Yeah. Santo Niño. I mean, you know, whether it literally was, but you talk about, I mean, those were people's homes. That's where people used to live. Should we feel guilty?
I don't think guilt is the right feeling. I think awareness is what the right feeling is. Mm-hmm. I think you should be empathetic and you should be thoughtful and you should realize where you're walking. I'm not going to tell people don't go to Dodger games. I still go to Dodger mm-hmm. games, but I do think it's fair to want the Dodgers to acknowledge that this happened and the city of LA and the county of LA to acknowledge that it happened, which none of them have really ever done in any meaningful way. I think it's fair to go to a Dodger game, sit out, eat your hot dog, no longer made by Farmer John, apparently.
Right.
And think, holy shit, you know, looking out at the parking lots, these were people's homes before. And really take a moment and reflect on that. And, you know, if you're not going to not spend money at Dodger Stadium, then maybe think about what you can do differently to prevent that from happening again. You know, it's happening in Inglewood right now. It's happening all over the place all the time. So be conscientious. But, you know, it's nothing is perfect. It's not like it's not like you're going to like save your money from the Dodgers and like live an ascetic lifestyle or like give up for the, you know, Padres who have plenty of their own problems, right, with their stadium and every other team. Like, it's not like, I don't know, you know, you're participating in society and society has some flaws.
Sure. In the words of, I think it was George Costanza, we live in a society, Jerry. Might have been Kramer from Seinfeld.
I think it was George. I think
was it George? So, I mean, the book just by itself is incredibly, it's so interesting about history. Me having lived in LA for a while, for about 12 or 13 years, you know, a lot of times when you're a transplant, you get more into the history of the place.
For sure.
And I mean, just so interesting. I thought I knew a lot, but I mean, you know, Parker, I knew about him, the former police chief, and even fair names that don't make a huge appearance in the book, like Dockweiler. You know, there's a, you know, Dockweiler Beach over there by the airport and all that. I mean, this becomes a whole different thing too with like, you know, the Confederate statues and that kind of thing. But I was just amazed at how many of those names that are affixed to LA institutions. And these are not people that you necessarily want to celebrate, right?
I mean, the early days of LA were very racist and very corrupt. To be frank about it, like LA was not like this multicultural city. It was a white Anglo-Saxon city where a few really wealthy oil barons and land developers ran things.
Right.
And those names often, either they come, the street names come from those families or they come from the, you know, Spanish families that preceded them, the Sepulvedas and the Picos and stuff like that.
Right. That's very true. I read your book maybe 2 or 3 days after I saw the movie, which not a good movie, but a great storyline, Ask the Dust. Have you seen that or read that book?
I've read the book.
The book is always better than the movie, right?
Yeah.
But yeah, it just made me think a lot about old LA and
It's Bunker Hill, another neighborhood that's been destroyed, right? It's like probably even more iconic in many ways than the Chavez Ravine neighborhoods was like the destruction of Bunker Hill.
Totally. Not a good movie, but a good book and a very interesting look into, I guess, 1930s LA life.
Yeah.
Right? John Fante, F-A-N-T-E, for those listening. There's no obvious bad guy, like one bad person necessarily in this story. You know, you want to have the villain, you want to have the Joker, whomever, even, you know, someone like Wilkinson, who we talked about, right? He wanted public housing, and it was public housing that first started to knock down the homes in those three neighborhoods, right? And they didn't end up even using it for public housing, et cetera, right? I wonder about this idea of finding fault. I mean, the Chandlers, you know, the LA Times family, they might qualify as the villains. You know, public housing in some ways has some good ideas. You know, even Roz Wyman, who should be celebrated as a woman who is a trailblazer as a politician, you know, she kind of put some of the nails in the coffin, so to speak. Do we blame the system, in quotes? Did you find villains? How does that come out in the end, in the wash?
I don't really like to think in terms of heroes and villains too much. I think it's not really productive in terms of telling a story. This is a nonfiction story. You know, you're trying to write about human beings who made the choices that they thought were the right choices at the time. And they had their own motivations, their own backgrounds that were leading them down certain paths. And that's really where I came from. And sometimes those motivations aligned with each other. And sometimes they worked, you know, cross purposes. Sometimes they were really unfortunate with what their actions, you know, resulted in. Sometimes they could have been the most noble and heroic people in the world and they still would have been screwed. I was interested in the idea of like, kind of the forces of history and individual lives and like how they intersect a little bit. And I was thinking about that stuff. But I wasn't, I conscientiously didn't want to write a book of good guys and bad guys, because I don't really think that that's how the world works.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that it's very clear that you have that strong journalistic background, because you were able to keep that objectivity, if that's the word. And yeah, it is very clear that you, not about heroes and villains. Frank Wilkinson, if we can kind of nudge towards heroes and villains a little bit though, right? I mean, he's more on the hero side, right? But maybe 51%, you know.
He's a complicated man.
He's a complicated man. He seemed like he really did have good things in mind. On the great podcast, I want to say, called Sports as a Weapon, right? Mm-hmm. I was just listening to recently. Shout out to Miguel, another Sacramento guy, for that. You were saying, you know, you guys were talking about kind of how grotesque it was, really. He would do these, like, what, slum tours?
He would, yeah. He would take a Greyhound bus and rent it and then fill it up with like housewives from Beverly Hills or whatever and take them through what he called slums. So they would experience, you know, the poverty of LA and understand why public housing was necessary. And that was like his way of building support for housing.
Wow. Yeah, that was tough to read for sure. But, you know, knowing his background and knowing how he came up, you do feel some sympathy for sure for him overall. If he was an evangelist for public housing, what do you think was his like conversion? Like what made him so strong and believing that public housing was the way to go?
He was from a conservative Christian background, mm-hmm. Methodist background, and he grew up in Beverly Hills, wealthy and in a politically active family. His father was like an anti-vice crusader in LA who had a really interesting life in his own right. And Frank went to UCLA and he had plans on becoming a Methodist minister. And then he went on this trip after college across the United States and then to Europe to go to the Holy Land. He wanted to see Christmas in Bethlehem. His first stop was in Chicago, and he saw, and this is in the Depression in the 30s, and he saw like the Jane Addams house, and she was this, you know, incredible sort of philanthropic person feeding the hungry. And he was blown away by the existence of poverty in America. Mm-hmm. He didn't even know it existed. Like, he had lived such a sheltered life. And then he gets to Europe and to the Middle East, and he sees it, and he just has this huge crisis of faith. Finally, at the end of his trip, he ends up in the Soviet Union, where he sees clean streets and, you know, in a very staged trip to the Soviet Union led by a tour guide. but I think that began to put these ideas in his head that, first of all, there's no God. And second of all, that maybe there's another way to organize a society. Gets back to LA and he's lost. You know, think of your like typical rich kid post-college in a malaise. Sure. And this Catholic priest comes to his door who has been working with the housing authority and is a housing advocate. And they become fast friends. And he takes Frank around LA, and Frank starts to believe in the mission of public housing. You know, and this is a very paternalistic version of progressivism, where it's like the government and architects and city planners telling poor people how to live, right? That's pretty much what he thought. He thought they could design a better life for people effectively. And, you know, you can see the appeal in public housing. Absolutely. You know, it'd be nice to organize a society not around buying things. It'd be nice to not have to worry about housing shortages the way that we're still dealing with them now. And they were definitely dealing with them then. But I don't think Frank really understood that he was also taking something away from people. And that was his great flaw when it comes to his work in housing.
Sure. Again, along with the idea of no villains, no heroes, Roy Ball, can you remind me of his first name? Was it Edward?
Ed, yeah.
Ed, right? Another name, you know, I know he's got at least one or two schools named after him and, you know, I think seen mostly as a hero. And Mexican-American and one of the trailblazing Mexican-American politicians, you know, some of the decisions that he made were, you know, maybe sped up or inadvertently kind of led to the end of these neighborhoods. I wonder if we could maybe finish with you talking about like just the life in the neighborhoods, the Palo Verde, the Bishop, the La Loma, mostly Mexican-American, a few generations by the time 1950s had gotten here. And it all started with the Areci Chicas from Monte Escobedo in Zacatecas, is that correct?
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, they weren't the first ones to live in those neighborhoods, but the book starts, you know, it follows their family in particular. you know, three neighborhoods that were sort of isolated, but within LA, they were mostly Mexican American. They started to really grow in the early 20s and kind of took off and mm-hmm. filled up, and it was mixed bag. You know, there was rough parts and there were nice parts. There was public schools and a church and lots of stores and actors who lived there and laborers who lived there. Mm-hmm. The police academy was next door to Palo Verde, you know, along Malvina Avenue where the Arechigas lived. It was just a neighborhood in LA, basically, you know, a little bit, I would say, like out of the way because of mm-hmm. the surrounding hills and Elysian Park being right there. This is a time, especially before the freeways, where, you know, that felt sort of like easier to get to. But then mm-hmm. when the freeways were built kind of around the base of these hills, the neighborhoods became more cut off, which I think contributed to people seeing them, people from the outside world, even including progressive, you know, type mm-hmm. writers like Carrie McWilliams, who's this great, you know, LA writer and great progressive activist of his time, you know, refer to these neighborhoods as backwards type places, mm-hmm. which was wrong.
Problematic for sure.
Yeah. Not even problematic, just like not factually correct, you know, mm-hmm. that they had running water and phones and electricity and all the normal stuff. You know, what they didn't have was any support from City Hall. They didn't have mm-hmm. all their streets paved because the city wasn't paving them. It's not, you know, you don't have to pave your own streets, generally speaking, right, in right. a city. You don't have to pay for your own bus service out of pocket. But, you know, these residents were organized and trying to get these things and trying to improve, you know, their infrastructure. But when it came time to pick a place to build an ambitious public housing project, it was very easy for the city mm-hmm. who had not offered resources, who had not done code enforcement, to say, well, look how poorly you're living, blah, blah, blah. It was sort of a self-fulfilling prophecy.
Yes. Again, it seems like the connections to modern day, unfortunately, are very glaring. A lot of like what you talked about there was resonating with me as I read the book, this idea of like blaming people for their quote unquote victimhood. Like you talk about like, oh, you know, these neighborhoods are backwards and this and that. It's like, well, like you said, pave our street, like pay attention to us unless, you know, except for when it's time for votes and that kind of thing. Right. I think that you did such a good job and pardon the corny baseball metaphor here, but kind of going from home plate to home plate, kind of coming back. Where you end with Monte Escobedo, you end with kind of where the story begins, your story, this book's story. I wonder if you could read the ending of the book, which is, you know, with Abrana and kind of looking back in time, maybe not literally.
Sure. Also, for the record, the book is called Stealing Home. I love a corny baseball metaphor.
That's true. Did you get talked out of that title, or
My editor, Ben Adams, came up with it, and okay. It took me a minute to like, at first he said it as a joke and we were like, ha ha. And then we thought, wait a minute, actually, it's a good idea. My mom had suggested Dugout as a title, like play on Dugout. Mm. And I had told her earlier on, I was like, Mom, I'm not going to put a corny baseball pun as a title of my book. Literally, I know.
Like, what? Yeah, right?
Yeah.
That's funny.
She was right all along. all right. So I'll read these last couple paragraphs.
Yeah, please.
In August, 1972, 50 years after she had come to Los Angeles, but now without her home and without her husband, Abrana Arechiga died. She was buried next to Manuel, on a hill, of course. They have matching rectangular grave markers etched with the scene of a sunrise coming over tall mountains set among the trees. Abrana was gone and Palo Verde was gone, and so was the Santo Niño church where she had prayed for so many years. But the old priest, Father Thomas Martin, was still alive. He had held on to the Santo Niño church registers. When Abrana died, he wrote her name into the book in the same looping cursive he had used for all the baptisms, marriages, and funerals that had marked the passing years in Palo Verde. She was still a part of the community. The church books are still there, sitting on a shelf in the rectory at St. Peter's on Broadway, about halfway between Dodger Stadium and City Hall. The lives of Palo Verde, La Loma, and Bishop scrawled onto the smudge pages. The life and death of Abrana Arechiga and the people she loved. The writing of the priest, shakier in old age, weaving one last thread back into Abrana's past. There were her parents' names, Basia Bañuelos and Juan Cabral. There was her daughter, Lola, as next of kin. There was her age, 75 years of life on earth. And there was her place of birth in Mexico, high up among the rocks.
Yeah, that image is chill-inducing for sure, that last image. Wow. Though that was the end of the book, if I could trouble you one more that I think is such a good summary of the book, just kind of on a macro level, it's the last paragraph of page 208.
Sure.
That begins.
I'm gonna be surprised.
Yeah, it begins with Costello. Thank you again. I appreciate you doing this.
No problem. So this is about Lou Costello, of Abbott and Costello, and they were the comedians.
I had it as like from Costello to Upkeep on page 209.
Okay. So yeah, I'm talking about the, should I introduce this or should we just roll
Please.
With it?
Whatever you think.
In the early 50s, LA really wanted a Major League Baseball team before they got the Dodgers. And among the people who really, really wanted a team were the comedians Abbott and Costello, the mm-hmm. Who's on First guys. So they're at City Hall talking about bringing a baseball team to LA. Costello, a man whose career had begun on the burlesque circuit, knew firsthand the temptations of celebrity that big league players encountered. But here he was, yet another American, bending baseball players into something more than mere mortals and willfully propagating the notion that a made-up game played with a bat and a ball could somehow reveal the highest spirit and ideals of a nation. The myth of baseball, like the myth of Los Angeles, required constant upkeep.
Whew. The myth of baseball, the myth of sport, the myth of Los Angeles, constant upkeep. Wow. I'll leave it there. Anything I say is going to diminish that because that's really well done.
Oh, thank you.
The question that probably a lot of writers don't like, what's next? What are you working on for the future?
I don't know. I don't have anything okay. for you. I'm sorry. Like I'm hoping to write another book, but I don't have one lined up yet.
Awesome. I appreciate that honesty. Well, thank you so much. Again, the book is really good. I've been so lucky to find my way into this kind of new generation of like Bradford Pearson's book about the Japanese American.
It's an incredible book.
Right?
Yeah.
Pete Corrado's book about basketball and hang time.
I haven't read his yet.
But just, you know, the best books about sports are not just about sports. And that clearly comes through in yours. Again, great job. 76 chapters. So many stories that seem to be disparate, and it just comes together. It's such a good book. I really appreciate it. I'm going to be promoting it like heck amongst friends and colleagues and family members and all that. So I really appreciate your time, and thanks for kind of putting us into the writer's lab a little bit. Thanks so much.
No, thank you for having me, and thanks for all the great questions and thought. I really appreciate it.
It's been a pleasure, and great luck with your continued writing, whatever that happens to be.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to episode 63 with Eric Nussbaum. You can now subscribe to the podcast on Apple Podcasts and please leave a 5-star review. You can also ask for the Chills of Will podcast by name using Alexa and find the pod on Stitcher, Spotify, and on Amazon Music. Follow me on Instagram where I'm at Chills of Will podcast or on Twitter where I'm at Chills at Will P-O-1. You can also watch most episodes on YouTube. You can watch and subscribe on the Chills of Will podcast channel. This is a passion project of mine, a DIY operation, and I'd love for your help in promoting what I'm convinced is a unique and spirited look at an often ignored art form. The intro song for the Chills of Will podcast is Wind Down, instrumental version, and the other song played on the episode is Hoops, instrumental by Matt Whitehour. Both great songs are used through archesaudio.com. For now, thanks again for listening. And I hope that these quarantine days bring you texts by writers with mad skills like Eric Nussbaum, whose work gives you chills at will.